Right now, your ability to sit upright and, just listen to this deep dive learner, it relies entirely on a handful of microscopic rocks resting on a bed of jelly located just behind your eyes.
Yeah, it sounds completely absurd when you phrase it that way, but I mean, those rocks are literally the foundation of your reality.
It's wild.
It is. Because usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this comforting expectation of precision, right? Like you break your arm, the x-ray shows a jagged white line, the doctor points to it, and well, you cast it.
Right, we prefer our biology to be visible,
Yeah.
neatly categorized.
Exactly. We like to see the problem.
But you step into the world of human equilibrium, though, and that x-ray machine becomes mostly useless. Our sense of balance is this diagnostic landscape that operates entirely invisible to the naked eye.
Totally invisible.
We are looking at a system hidden deep inside the temporal bone of the skull, which, I mean, most people completely ignore until the terrifying moment just stops working.
Which is really the core mission of today's deep dive. We are unpacking a fascinating set of medical presentation notes from Professor Dr. Ali Dinesh.
Yes, his notes are incredible.
They really are. His work details the human vestibular system, which we can accurately call the body's ultimate hidden human GPS. So we're going to decode the complex anatomy of this system and, look at the utterly chaotic disorders that happen when it glitches.
Okay, let's unpack this because the stakes here are incredibly high for something so small. I mean, this biological machinery is quietly running in the background every single second of your life.
Every second. Yeah.
Whether you're running a marathon, walking down the stairs, or just turning your head to check your blind spot in traffic, this system is calculating your exact position in three-dimensional space.
Right, just to keep your posture upright and your vision clear.
So, to understand how we maintain that equilibrium, we first have to visualize the bizarre architecture hidden inside the inner ear.
Right, because most of us think of the ear purely as an organ for hearing, the spiral-shaped cochlea.
The classic snail shell shape.
Exactly, the snail shell. But sharing that exact same space, literally attached to it, is the peripheral vestibular system.
And looking at the anatomical diagrams in Dr. Dinesh's notes,
Yeah.
it resembles an alien labyrinth.
It really does.
You have these hard, fluid-filled, bony canals,
Yeah.
and suspended inside those bony tunnels are softer, membranous tubes. And within this entire complex structure, there are only five specialized sensors in each ear.
Right, just five. So 10 microscopic sensors total in your entire head, keeping you from falling flat on your face.
It's hard to believe that's enough.
Well, they're highly specialized. They're divided into two teams, essentially. Team one consists of the three semicircular canals,
Okay.
and they are positioned at roughly right angles to each other, named the superior, posterior, and horizontal canals. And their exclusive job is to sense angular acceleration.
Angular acceleration. So that simply means rotational movement, right?
Exactly.
That covers shaking your head no, nodding yes, or like tilting your head ear to shoulder.
Precisely. They map your rotation in three-dimensional space. And then you have team two, which is the two otolith organs. They're known as the utricle and the saccule.
The utricle and saccule. Got it.
Right. And their job is to sense linear acceleration.
So straight line movement, like riding in an elevator going up and down, or sitting in a car that suddenly accelerates forward.
Yeah, or just the constant static pull of gravity itself.
You know, this maps perfectly to the technology we carry in our pockets. Like a smartphone knows when you're rotating to watch a video in landscape mode,
Oh, absolutely.
and it knows if you drop it off a table. So the semicircular canals in our ears are functioning exactly like the microscopic gyroscopes in a phone detecting rotation, while the otolith organs are the accelerometers sensing up, down, and forward motion.
The engineering parallels are striking, honestly. Our devices are direct mimicries of this biological hardware, but, knowing the shapes of these fluid-filled canals introduces a mechanical problem. Well, fluid sloshing around inside a membranous tube does not magically equal an electrical signal that the brain can read. There has to be a physical translator in there.
A way to convert fluid dynamics into neurochemistry.
Exactly. And the translator is the sensory epithelium, the specialized lining of these tubes, which contains the vestibular hair cells.
And just to be clear, these are not anything like the hair on your head,
Right.
right?
Oh, no, not at all. Under an electron microscope, a vestibular hair cell looks like a tiny bundle of bristles called stereocilia. And at the very edge of this bundle sits one main, significantly taller hair called the kinocilium.
It kind of looks like a microscopic set of panpipes, getting progressively taller until you reach the canocilium at the end.
That's a perfect way to visualize it, and that structural asymmetry is the entire secret to how they function. These hair cells, they communicate with your brain continuously, even when you're sitting perfectly still.
Really, even at rest.
Yeah. At rest, they fire electrical action potentials at a baseline rate of 90 spikes per second.
Wait, 90 times a second? Firing 90 times a second while I'm just sitting on the couch seems like a massive waste of cellular energy. I mean, why wouldn't the system just idle at zero and only fire an electrical spike when I actually move my head?
It seems counterintuitive, I know, but idling at zero would create a massive blind spot. By hovering at 90 spikes per second, the system builds in bidirectional sensitivity.
Good, bidirectional, meaning it can go up or down.
Exactly. Think of it like a car engine idling in a neutral gear. If the fluid in your inner ear shifts and pushes that bundle of shorter hairs toward the tall canthocilium, the cell's internal voltage flips, it depolarizes.
So it gets excited.
Right, the cell gets excited and its firing rate revs up to 180 spikes per second.
And the brain reads that sudden spike and knows the head is turning one way.
Exactly. But if the fluid pushes the hairs in the opposite direction, away from the tall canthocilium, the cell hyperpolarizes.
It gets inhibited.
Yes. And the firing rate drops dramatically down to 10 spikes per second. So if the baseline was zero, the system wouldn't have any room to drop its firing rate to signal movement in the opposite direction.
Ah, the push-pull dynamic.
Yeah.
So let's say I turn my head quickly to the left. The fluid inside the canals lags behind due to momentum.
Right, inertia.
So in my left ear, the fluid pushes the hairs toward the tall canthocilium, exciting the cell to 180 spikes.
Yep.
But in my right ear, the geometry is mirrored, so the fluid pushes the hairs away, dropping the rate to 10. The brain sees high voltage from the left, low voltage from the right, and calculates a left turn in milliseconds.
Spot on, that beautifully covers the fluid mechanics in the semicircular canals. But we still have to address the otolith organs, you know, the ones sensing gravity and straight line acceleration.
This is where we get back to those microscopic rocks we mentioned at the start. Because fluid sloshing around handles spinning, but fluid alone can't effectively measure the static downward pull of gravity.
What's fascinating here is how the body solves this. In the utricle and saccule, those same asymmetrical hair cells are embedded in a thick gelatinous material called the otolithic membrane.
Okay, the jelly.
Right, the jelly. And sitting heavily on top of that jelly are the otoconia. They are literal calcium carbonate crystals.
Ear stones, actual dense rocks sitting inside our skulls. That's insane.
It's incredible, right? And it all comes down to inertial mass. Because calcium crystals are significantly heavier than the surrounding jelly and fluid, they are highly susceptible to gravity. So when you tilt your head forward to look at your shoes, gravity grabs onto those
They
stones.
slide downward, and because they're embedded in the jelly, they drag the jelly with them, physically bending the hair cells underneath.
Exactly.
So the sheer weight of the stones creates the mechanical bend that triggers the electrical spike.
We are entirely governed by the physics of rocks dragging jelly. Yeah. And once those hair cells bend, whether from fluid in the canals or stones in the otoliths, that electrical signal, the 180 or the 10, it has to travel through the central wiring to actually keep you from falling over. The signals exit the inner ear via the eighth cranial nerve.
And the notes highlight a very specific anatomical bottleneck here. The eighth cranial nerve shares a very tight bony tunnel, the internal auditory canal, with the facial nerve,
Right.
which of course controls your facial expressions.
And clinically, this is a vital piece of real estate. Dr. Dinesh points out that the most common benign tumor in this area, a vestibular schwannoma, grows on the balance nerve, but it's trapped in that tiny bony tunnel.
So there's nowhere for it to go.
Exactly. As it expands, it crushes both the balance nerve and the facial nerve next to it. So a patient might walk into a clinic complaining of dizzy spells, but the doctor will notice the side of their face is slightly drooping.
That's a huge diagnostic clue. But assuming the nerves are healthy, those movement signals travel down the eighth cranial nerve into the brainstem, specifically to the vestibular nuclei.
Yep, the main hub.
And from there, the data branches out to the thalamus, the cerebral cortex, and straight down the spinal cord to trigger automatic reflexes.
Right, and the brain uses this raw data to execute three main reflexes, completely bypassing conscious thought. You don't even have to think about it. The first is the vestibulospinal reflex, or VSR.
VSR, okay.
This sends signals straight down to your body's anti-gravity muscles.
So, like, if you step on a patch of ice and your feet suddenly slip to the right, your inner ear detects that violent linear acceleration.
Right.
And before you even consciously realize you're falling, the VSR has already fired the muscles on the left side of your body, shooting your left arm out and stiffening your left leg to catch your center of mass.
Exactly. It's a lifesaver. The second reflex operates on a similar principle but targets a different area. That's the vestibulocolic reflex, or VCR.
VCR.
This route signals specifically to your neck muscles to stabilize your head in space, completely independent of what your body is doing.
Oh, you see this clearly in sports like downhill mountain biking.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
The rider's body is violently bouncing up and down over rocks and roots. But if you watch their head, it stays remarkably level, tracking the trail. The VCR is constantly firing tiny micro-adjustments to the neck muscles to absorb the shock and keep the skull stable.
Yeah, and you can also see a highly exaggerated version of this if you pick up a chicken and move its body around. The bird's head will stay perfectly locked in midair.
Oh, yeah, the famous chicken head tracking video.
Exactly, that's the VCR in action.
So what's the third reflex?
The third reflex mentioned in the notes connects the vestibular system directly to the muscles controlling your eyeballs. That's the vestibulo-ocular reflex, or VOR.
VOR. I tend to think of the VOR as a biological steadicam. You know, those complex, shock-absorbing harnesses that camera operators wear in movies so they can run down a bumpy hallway while the camera footage stays perfectly smooth.
That's a great analogy. Without the VOR, your daily life would be unlivable. Every time your foot hit the pavement while jogging, the visual world would bounce and blur like shaky handheld footage.
It's amazing. If you shake your head side to side quickly while reading a street sign, the text stays perfectly sharp. The VOR takes the exact rotation data from your inner ear, say, a head turn to the left at 50 degrees per second, and instantly counter-rotates your eyes to the right at exactly 50 degrees per second.
Perfect cancellation.
It perfectly cancels out the head movement to stabilize your gaze.
The intimacy of that connection between the ears and the eyes is profound, and it also sets up the diagnostic logic for the rest of Dr. Dinesh's notes. Because if these reflexes are hardwired, we have to look at what happens when the human GPS glitches.
Right. What happens when the inner ear breaks and sends fraudulent signals to the brain?
Well, the system crashes. The inner ear tells the brain, we are spinning violently to the left, but the eyes are looking at a stationary room and reporting, we are standing perfectly still.
Total contradiction.
Yeah, the brain cannot reconcile the conflicting data, and the physiological response to that sensory mismatch is severe. You experience profound loss of balance, intense spinning known as vertigo, and overwhelming nausea and emesis.
Emesis being the clinical term for vomiting.
Yes, exactly. It is basically motion sickness without the motion.
Now, diagnosing the root cause of this vertigo seems nearly impossible. Doctors can't just cut open the skull to check if the ear stones are in the right place.
No, thankfully not.
But the notes outline a diagnostic shortcut, which is tracking the exact duration of the vertigo spells.
Right, because the timing exposes the underlying mechanism. If a patient says the vertigo only lasts for a few seconds when they move their head in a specific way, the diagnosis points heavily toward BPPV.
Benign paroxysmal positional vertigo.
Exactly.
Let's look at the mechanics of BPPV, because this is fascinating. Those ear stones you talked about, the otoconia, they're supposed to be glued to the jelly in the utricle.
Right.
But sometimes, due to head trauma or just aging, a few of those microscopic rocks break loose. They float away and fall into one of the semicircular canals, usually the posterior canal, where they absolutely do not belong.
Right. They become rogue rocks. So when the patient tilts their head backward, say to look up at a high shelf, those heavy rocks roll down the curvature of the canal. And as they roll, they push the fluid like a plunger, forcefully bending the hair cells and creating a massive fake signal of rotation.
And the vertigo only lasts for a few seconds because, well, it only takes a few seconds for the rocks to reach the bottom of the canal and settle.
Yep, gravity does its thing.
Once they stop rolling, the fluid stops moving, the hair cells spring back up, and the spinning stops. So seconds of vertigo equals falling rocks.
Exactly. Now, if the vertigo lasts for minutes, the mechanism changes. It usually points to a vestibular migraine or transient vascular issues.
Like blood flow problems.
Yeah. The blood vessels supplying the inner ear briefly constrict, starving the hair cells of oxygen and causing them to misfire. Once the blood flow returns a few minutes later, the system stabilizes.
Okay, moving up the timeline. If the severe spinning lasts for hours at a time, often accompanied by hearing loss and a low roaring sound in the ear, the notes point to Meniere's disease.
Meniere's is fundamentally an internal plumbing issue. The membranous tubes of the inner ear are filled with a specific fluid called endolymph.
Endolymph, okay.
And this fluid is constantly being produced and drained. But in Meniere's disease, the drainage system gets clogged.
So the fluid backs up like a blocked sink.
Precisely. Mm. The pressure steadily builds inside the inner ear, physically stretching the delicate membranes and suffocating the hair cells.
That sounds incredibly painful and disorienting.
It is. This massive pressure differential causes hours of chaotic misfiring. The vertigo only subsides when the body finally manages to slowly reabsorb the fluid or force it past the blockage, which takes hours.
Wow. Finally, if the spinning lasts for days on end without stopping, the notes say it indicates vestibular neuronitis or labyrinthitis.
Yes. This is usually a viral infection, like the herpes simplex virus or even just a severe cold, that has attacked and inflamed the entire eighth cranial nerve.
Oh, so the nerve itself is sick.
Right. The nerve is effectively short-circuiting, and the vertigo will not stop until the viral inflammation naturally burns itself out over several days.
So duration provides the map, but clinical testing provides the proof. Almost all vestibular testing involves recording the patient's eyes to look for nystagmus.
Yes, nystagmus.
Which is a rhythmic, involuntary, oscillating motion of the eyeballs. The eyes slowly drift in one direction, then quickly snap back to the center.
And clinicians define nystagmus by the direction of the fast snap. So if the eyes drift right and snap left, it is a left-beating nystagmus. Dr. Dinesh lists two main ways to measure this, VNG and ENG.
Video nystagmography and electron nystagmography.
Exactly. VNG is exactly what it sounds like. The doctor places large goggles over the patient's eyes, blocking out all light, and infrared cameras inside the goggles track the exact movements of the pupil in the dark.
ENG, on the other hand, uses electrodes, which is wild because the eyeball actually acts like a tiny battery, right?
It does, yeah.
The front of the eye has a positive charge, and the back has a negative charge. So by placing sticky electrode patches on the skin around the eyes, doctors can measure shifts in the electrical field as the eyeball rotates back and forth.
It's very clever. Both tests are looking for those eye twitches. And the reason we look at the eyes to diagnose the ears brings us right back to the vestibulo-ocular reflex, that biological steadicam.
Right.
The ears directly control the eye muscles. If the inner ear is broken and sending fake movement signals, the brain thinks the head is turning. It slowly moves the eyes to compensate, realizes it made a mistake, and snaps them back.
Twitching eyes are the visible alarm bells for an invisible ear problem.
Perfectly said.
Now, the most fascinating test to trigger these alarm bells is caloric irrigation.
Oh, yes.
Doctors artificially induce vertigo by literally shooting cold or warm water directly into a patient's ear canal.
I know, it seems bizarre to use water temperature to test balance, but it relies on basic thermodynamics. The eardrum separates the outer ear canal from the middle ear, and just behind that sits the inner ear and the horizontal semicircular canal.
And heat rises and cold sinks.
Exactly.
So when you flood the outer ear with warm water, it heats up the temporal bone, which slightly heats up the fluid inside the horizontal canal on that side. The warmer fluid becomes lighter and rises.
And that rising fluid creates an artificial convection current. The moving fluid bends the hair cells, tricking the brain into thinking the head is turning toward that ear.
Wow.
Because of the hardwired reflexes, the eyes immediately start twitching.
And doctors use the acronym COWS, C-O-W-S, cold opposite, warm same.
Yep, it's a classic mnemonic.
So if you shoot cold water into the right ear, the fluid sinks, and the eyes will beat toward the opposite side, the left. If you shoot warm water into the right ear, the fluid rises and the eyes beat toward the same side, the right.
Exactly right.
And if the doctor shoots the water in and the eyes do absolutely nothing, they know the nerve on that side is completely dead.
It is a brilliant way to bypass head movement and test each ear's hardware independently. Once the tests map out the exact pathology, we arrive at the treatments, which span from basic physics to surgical extremes.
Right. So for the fluid pressure of Meniere's disease, I mean, you can't surgically fix the microscopic drain easily. So treatments focus on a strict low-salt diet and diuretics to reduce overall fluid retention in the body, just hoping it reduces pressure in the ear.
Right. And doctors also prescribe vestibular suppressants like Valium to literally sedate the hyperactive nerve.
But chemical sedation doesn't help with BPPV, where physical ear stones have fallen into the wrong semicircular canal. To fix that, doctors use canalip repositioning.
Most commonly, the Epley maneuver.
Yes, the Epley maneuver. This turns the patient's head into a 3D puzzle. Think of those little plastic maze games where you have to tilt the board to roll a silver ball bearing into a hole.
That is exactly what it's like.
The doctor tilts the patient's head backward at a specific 45-degree angle and just waits for gravity to pull the microscopic rocks to the lowest part of the canal hoop.
Then they slowly rotate the head 90 degrees to the side, rolling the rocks into the next quadrant. Finally, the patient rolls entirely onto their shoulder, facing the floor.
And this final angle drops the stones out of the semicircular canal and right back into the uterine jelly where they belong.
Yep. By using gravity and geometry, you can cure a patient of highly debilitating vertigo in about 3 minutes without a single pill or incision. It's really amazing.
It's elegant. But if the problem isn't a misplaced rock, if the hair cells themselves are fundamentally diseased and sending relentless, chaotic data, the treatments become much more aggressive, don't they?
They do. When a patient's quality of life is destroyed by constant vertigo, doctors turn to chemical ablation. They inject a vestibulotoxic agent, usually a specific antibiotic called gentamicin, directly through the eardrum into the middle ear, where it absorbs into the inner ear.
And vestibulotoxic basically means it is intentionally poisonous to the balance system.
Yes, intentionally poisonous. The chemical specifically targets and destroys the dark cells that produce the inner ear fluid, and it kills the vestibular hair cells.
Wow.
The goal is to silence the chaotic noise by neutralizing the sensors entirely. But it requires extreme precision with dosing to kill the balance cells without letting the poison seep over and permanently destroy the hearing cells in the adjacent cochlea.
It's a total scorched earth approach.
Yeah.
And when even that fails, the absolute last resort is a labyrinthectomy.
Yeah.
A surgeon goes in and physically drills out or removes the entire bony and membranous labyrinth. They completely destroy the balance organ on that side of the head.
It forces the brain to give up on that ear entirely. The central nervous system undergoes a process called vestibular compensation. It essentially rewrites its own algorithms, learning to rely exclusively on the single healthy ear, the eyes, and the body's physical sensors to maintain balance.
It really puts into perspective just how vital accurate data is to the brain. I mean, completely destroying the sensor is preferable to letting it send corrupt data.
Absolutely. When you synthesize all the mechanics we've covered today, you know, the membranous tubes mapping three-dimensional space, the hair cells idling at 90 spikes a second, the calcium stones relying on gravity, and those lightning-fast reflexes catching us before we fall, it really is a masterpiece of evolutionary engineering.
It is. So to you, the learner, the next time you turn your head to look at something and your vision remains perfectly crisp, just take a fraction of a second to appreciate the silent human GPS throwing millions of signals behind your eyes to keep your world steady.
And there is one final implication of all this mechanics to leave you with, something that stretches beyond clinical notes and into the extremes of human exploration.
Oh, right.
Because our entire otolith system, our ability to sense up from down, relies on the constant downward pull of gravity dragging on those heavy calcium ear stones.
Right, the weight of the rocks bends the jelly.
Exactly. So consider what happens to the mental mapping of astronauts. When they live on the International Space Station in microgravity for 6 months, those stones are no longer pulled down.
They just float weightlessly in the jelly. The internal accelerometer basically flatlines.
The biological hardware is suddenly useless. The brain has to completely rewrite its own code to survive in a zero-gravity environment, heavily prioritizing visual data over the silent inner ear.
That's wild.
Which leads to the inevitable question, you know? What kind of sensory chaos erupts in their minds the very second they land back on Earth and gravity suddenly grabs those floating stones and yanks them down again?
Oh, man. That sensory recalibration would be a deep dive all on its own. For now, though, the next time you feel perfectly balanced on solid ground, thank your ear stones.